When I first started The Third Story, I thought I was chasing the definitive career-spanning conversation. The one interview to rule them all. And that's why for the first decade, I didn't often repeat the guests I talked to. The only person I regularly spoke with more than once was my dad. But over time, I came to realize there's no such thing as a singular definitive interview with anybody. From one day to the next, people change their stories. Over the course of months or years, we become different people. There's a quote often attributed to the Dalai Lama that says, every 7 years, all of our cells are replaced, and that we're literally new people. It turns out that there's no record of him ever saying that, and that the science doesn't really hold up either. Some cells are constantly renewed, yes, but others, like those in the heart and the brain, may last a lifetime. There's a kind of a poetic justice in that. Our head and heart stay with us even as the rest of the body is in flux. Still, the metaphor persists, and for good reason. We are always in a state of becoming, always transforming. And seen through that lens, these interviews are just a single frame in the movie of a person's life. While we'd like to believe that we're the directors of our own stories, the truth is we leave whole scenes on the cutting room floor, sometimes unintentionally, or we rewrite them later when the context changes. And so I have come to rewrite the story of this very project, and now from time to time, I revisit past guests to see what has changed, how far they've traveled, how many cells have been replaced, and what might have been left on the cutting room floor. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. 7 years ago, I interviewed Mary Sweeney on the porch of her summer home in Madison, Wisconsin. Every year when I go home to visit my family there, I try to sit down with at least one guest. Over time, the Madison conversations with people like Laurie Moore, David Marinus, Richie Davidson, Michael Feldman, Ben Wickler, and Mary Sweeney have come to hold a special place in this project and in my own memory. They're a kind of a low-key love letter to my hometown. When we spoke in 2018, Mary was already a friend. I'd actually known of her years before I met her. She was like a phantom to me when I was in college at the University of Wisconsin. She was a Madison native who lived in LA and edited films with her partner, both in work and in life, David Lynch. And I heard that they spent their summers in Madison. I didn't properly meet Mary until after I'd moved to New York. But one summer, when I was back home, a woman approached me after a show that I had played, and she said that she was Mary's assistant, and that Mary wanted to talk to me about scoring a film she was working on. So we met for lunch at her family's restaurant. She comes from a big Madison family. And we got to know each other a little bit. I did not end up doing the music, but that meeting was our start. Over time, Mary became close with my parents, and I started finding myself at these epic daytime parties with wine and limoncello and sprawling afternoon-long conversations about art and craft. So by the time we sat down to record that 2018 interview, we had a kind of shorthand. But good dinner party banter doesn't mean that you know someone's story. Not really. And I wanted to know. How did she go from growing up in Madison in the 60s to collaborating so intimately with one of the most iconoclastic directors of our time? How did her story intersect with the broader arc of late 20th century film? By the time we spoke, she'd established herself not only as a film editor and a producer, but also as a screenwriter, a professor, and a director, too. And I wondered, what did it mean to be the editor and the producer behind films like Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive, and The Straight Story, which she also wrote? And what was it like to do that kind of work with someone you also shared your life with? For those enthusiastic fans of David Lynch, there is nothing I could say that would adequately sum up or characterize the significance of his work. But for those who may have only followed him casually, I think it's helpful to put it into some kind of perspective. He really was one of the most influential and visionary filmmakers of his generation. A recent reminder of his reach came earlier this summer when the New York Times published two lists of the 100 best films of the 21st century so far. One of the lists was made by film professionals and the other by readers. And David Lynch's Mulholland Drive, which was edited and produced by Mary Sweeney, ranked number 2 on both lists. So Mary and I had our conversation back in 2018, and it was rich, wide-ranging, intimate. But I hadn't really thought about it much in the years that followed, even when Mary and I would run into each other. When Lynch passed away in January and the tributes and obits began to roll in, I realized how little attention was being paid to Mary's contribution. While they had remained connected, both their professional and their personal relationship was over by then. It became clear that our podcast conversation was more relevant than ever. So I reshared it. In my post at the time, I wrote that the conversation had deepened into something more resonant, more nuanced, and more important in the wake of David's passing. I called it a time capsule, a snapshot of a moment that would never happen again. But I also knew intuitively that Mary's story wasn't finished, that her perspective had inevitably shifted. And sure enough, when we spoke about it a few weeks later, Mary told me she was hoping to revisit that conversation, not to correct it necessarily, but to expand it, to pick up a few scenes from the cutting room floor, and to write a few new ones. So we agreed to meet again, this time in Paris in June. I was there performing, and she was on what has become a kind of annual pilgrimage for her. So nearly 7 years to the day from our first interview, we sat in her Saint-Germain hotel room to talk about meaning, time, transformation, and what Paris means to her now. What's remarkable to me about this conversation is how it contains both growth and grief. She's in the thick of processing something major, reckoning in real time with the weight of legacy, love, and loss, and how to move forward. There's a deep vulnerability to this follow-up. It's more personal, more spacious, more unresolved. And it's her willingness, her insistence even, on revealing that part of herself that moves me the most. I found her in a kind of in-between space, eager to write the next chapter, but drawn to the mystery of the past. But aren't we all? If you would like to revisit the past, episodes of this podcast, visit third-story.com, unreluctantly, and you will find all those wonderful Madison episodes, including my first talk with Mary, and hundreds of deep dives with members of the creative class. My Substack, leosidran.substack.com, is where you'll find all the latest posts, podcast and otherwise, like my recent reflection on seeing a fish concert while tripping on mushrooms. And don't forget, we are made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios to discover more about their award-winning content. Here is me and Mary Sweeney in a Paris hotel room, talking it down. I loved walking into this Parisian hotel room just now and hearing you order coffee in French, because it is like a proof of something that I know has been real for you for a long time. This is a part of your life also.
Absolutely, yeah. We made a lot of movies with French financiers. All the films I produced for David were financed by French companies. First company called CB 2000, CB2000, and then Studio Canal. Yeah.
So what do you feel when you come here?
You know, I've had many lives. I came here as a student when I was in the university. I came and took a summer language course, and then I came back and lived here for a year after I'd been out of college and working in New York in publishing for a couple of years, and I had no money at all. Then I just would try to come back whenever I could. Then there was a long period of time where my life just didn't include coming to Paris. And then, amazingly, it became a very important part of my work with David, and it became a huge part of David's life, and a really important part of his life. I mean, the films he made, once we started being financed by the French, he had total creative control over those films, and it went from, the first one was Fire Walk With Me, which kind of ripped the lid off of Twin Peaks, and then Lost Highway, and The Straight Story, and Mulholland Drive, and Inland Empire eventually was picked up by Studio Canal, although it was fairly self-financed for a long time.
Do you think it's a function of France or of David that they wanted to support his films? What do you think they recognized in him that wasn't being recognized in the States?
Well, what they recognized as a cultural nation is the creative rights of artists, and they cherish and honor the creative rights of artists. You know, for example, if a film wins at Cannes, the director goes up and gets the award and takes it home.
As opposed to the producer.
The producer who gets the Oscar, yeah. So most strong filmmakers like Chris Nolan, people like that, they take a producing credit, so they're up there. But by the time he was approached by this man, Francis Bouygues, who was creating this company, or he bought the company, a small production company, CB 2000, in about 1990, I think. He had just retired. He was the head of Bouygues International, a giant construction company. They built the Channel, huge company, very wealthy. And he retired, and he loved cinema, and he just wanted to start making movies. So he basically created this company, and with counsel from a couple of cinephiles, people working for a long time, as reviewers, as producers in the French film world, who counseled him that if you give them Final Cut, they will come.
Mm-hmm.
So they built a stable of amazing filmmakers, Amir Kusturica, Wim Wenders, Pedro Almodovar, Jane Campion, David. But David was the beginning of it. And the first film that they produced was Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, and it went to Cannes in competition and didn't really do too well, but that's all been rewritten now.
What do you mean?
There's been a real revisionist perspective on that film, and also on Lost Highway, which were not well reviewed. And Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me was a bitter disappointment to people who were wanting Twin Peaks TV and got Twin Peaks, a David Lynch feature. So this was kind of, I mean, David's lawyers and David, and we all were sort of skeptical. It didn't seem like it was real that this very wealthy man was going to give people the budget and leave their hands off of it.
And did he recoup? Did he make his money back?
Yeah. Yeah, because our budgets aren't very big.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, The Straight Story was recouped before we even started shooting.
Sure.
In advance sales.
Yeah.
Distribution deals. So, it wasn't a risk, and he could afford to lose money, but he didn't lose money with us. I don't know about all the films.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, he died a couple of years later, and that's what happened to that company.
I see. So that helps to set the stage a little bit about, you know, your work life in France and just what it means. But I guess maybe to pull back a little bit and take a bird's eye view of what we're doing here, Mary, like, what are you thinking about? Why have another conversation today about your life and career and work and whatever we're talking about?
When did we have that last conversation, by the way? What year was that?
I want to say 2018.
It was before COVID.
Definitely before COVID.
Yeah, that sounds
definitely
right.
Before COVID.
Well, a lot has happened, and most significantly, David has passed away in January. And I have heard, many people have listened to that podcast. You've told me that, but other people have as well. And I am happy with that podcast, but I also felt like the lens has changed on David for the world, for me, for his sons and his daughters. And it just seemed, you know, when you and I first talked about it, it seemed like a good idea to talk again.
How do you see that the lens has changed?
You know, every day it changes on me. It's not like I've decided anything. It's just very different when someone's no longer on Earth with us. And I think the world feels that, and certainly his family, everybody in his family does. And so I think it's sort of, I'm sure that people who worked with him and haven't been in touch with him for years, you just go back and you relive things. And so even though we've been divorced for 20 years, it's still a significant loss. So part of the lens is second loss is a different loss. Divorce is one kind of loss, and then death is another.
Yeah.
And it's not really that far into things. I mean, the grieving process is, you know, the first year is every part of it is different, especially for his children, I would say. And I was surprised that I was going through things, but there it was, you know.
Maybe in part because you have a son together, and so as he's mourning his father, you're also, you're mourning it in multiple ways. You're mourning for him and with him and also for your own loss.
Yes, it's very different, you know, to be the child of someone like David and or to be the child who loses a parent. But I'm just, you know, things impacting me, surprising me that I didn't really expect. And that's changing still.
It's such a layered relationship because you have a deeply personal relationship and a professional relationship. I mean, I felt that you were very open when we talked about your work with David. Actually, the one piece of it that you didn't want me to go too deeply into was sort of the beginning of it and the end of it. But I can also see how it's hard to tease those things apart. And so, like, you know, the work is the work. The work speaks for itself and stands on its own, and you can speak about that endlessly. And that doesn't have to imply a personal relationship, although in your case it did. So I can imagine that it's just a lot of pieces to try to untangle and process.
Our life was tied up in work and personal, absolutely interwoven. So, of course, memories, you know, coming back to you, and, of course, so many people who you knew in all those years who want nothing more than to talk. I've met with a couple of people in Paris this week who were very important in David's life, and it's really great to talk. I know, we're just processing it. All of us are processing it, and you find out all these things. You know, I introduced David to tandem when we first started coming out there, and he didn't really have much practice making prints, mm-hmm. and that really took off for him at tandem. So every time he came, he was making a lot of work
there
every year. Yeah. And we were coming, we were staying in Wisconsin for long stretches then because Riley was not in school yet.
I remember hearing that he was there, and mm-hmm. that it was like a phantom. It was like I would hear that David Lynch had come in
There'd
for dinner.
There'd been sightings,
yes. There'd been sightings like Bigfoot. But I never saw him.
So we bought the house in 1992 when Riley was born. But we didn't start using it until 93. We made some changes.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, before Riley, as long as we weren't shooting, and, you know, he had this, our boat, our beautiful boat there, and he was really enjoying the break. Mm. As much as he loves L.A., he really loved being in Madison, and we would, like, put the golf clubs in the boat and go over to Bishop's Bay and golf with my brother.
So how many help a month a year or a couple months
Well,
a year?
No, at the beginning, we came out to Madison when Riley was like a month old. Mm-hmm. He was born here in Paris. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know that.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, he was. So we were presenting Twin Peaks Firewalk with me about the same week that his delivery date was.
I see.
And so either David was not going to be present at Riley's birth because he'd be here, you know, in competition with the film in Cannes, or I would go with him and I'd have the baby here. And I was very cavalier. It sounded like a great idea to me. So
how far in advance did you come?
I came over maybe like 7.5 months pregnant.
Right.
Yeah.
And already that's, they kind of,
it's pretty late.
That,
you know, people were kind of nervous about it, and everything went well. And they flew us first to New York and put us up for a couple of days there, and then flew us to Paris 3 hours on the Concorde.
On Concorde.
Yeah. So we were quite early. I think we were about 6 weeks before the Cannes Festival, and we were in Paris all that time. And I went to see the doctor, and he said, everything looks great. You can go to Cannes. I don't see any problems with that. It's a short flight, etc. So we did, and when I came back from Cannes, the next day I went back to see the doctor, and I had an ultrasound, and they discovered that Riley was breech.
Mm-hmm.
So I just came back that night, and they had a C-section the next morning, and everything went fine. Great.
Okay, so Riley then is a few months old, and you've been through this experience, and you decide to retreat to Madison for the summer.
Yes, we're going to go to Madison. We don't have the house, and David gets the boat brought out from where it was, and we're staying with my mom, who lives on Lake Mendota and has, you know, very small two-bedroom house. And Mom vacated her master suite and gave that to me and David and Riley. And we were there for 5 weeks living with my mom, and it was really great.
Did they get along?
Well, my dad was gone by that time, but David loved my mom. And he loved my family, the whole family. And they loved him. That was really great. That was a beautiful thing to be sharing that with my mom, living with her. She was really happy, loved having us there. And then we bought the house that summer that was just up the shoreline from my mom's, and both my sisters also lived in the same area on the lake. I mean, in the first 4 years of Riley's life, 5 years maybe, we were out there for long stretches, not just for the summer, because I wasn't teaching then, and Riley wasn't in school, and we weren't shooting anything. We weren't in pre-production on anything yet, so that was really great, and it was very nice. He had a workshop in the basement, and he started going to tandem, you know.
And you were in L.A. the rest of the time?
Rest of the year, we'd go back to L.A.,
Was he recognized more in L.A. than he was in Madison, or was he
definitely
not?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he could go to the hardware store, you know, like,
well,
as himself in Madison.
That's what I'm thinking, if maybe there was something kind of like of a relief of just being able to live a little more of an anonymous.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, he was very happy there in those early years.
Yeah.
Like I said, we were golfing a lot. Hmm. We were fishing a lot.
Did you have, outside of your family, did he have friends? Did he connect with people in Madison?
No. No.
He didn't really get involved in the scene.
No, he doesn't. You know, he's too busy making art wherever he is. You know, he doesn't.
Did he have friends?
You know, we were all really busy working on movies. That took up all our time.
Yeah.
And all our friends were with us. You know, the crew, the lawyers, the agents, the whole kind of thing. That's what our circle was.
Yes.
And, you know, and there were people who were consistent through all those things, like the lawyers. Mm. And then people that repeated working with him. But everybody at that time, they were doing other projects. And there was a lot of time between David's projects. But he is definitely someone who's really focused on using as much time in his life as he can to be creative and make art.
I notice that I keep talking about David in the past tense, and you are talking about him in the present tense.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which I think is beautiful, and also it's like he's still real. He still is a presence, a reality in your life.
Yes. I mean, he's been a huge presence in all our lives. I mean, he's looms very large in everybody's life. But it's interesting you say that, because I have... But, you know, I've been reading certain books by this man named Juhani Palasma. He's a very renowned Finnish architect, really a beautiful person. And I can't even remember how I stumbled upon him, but I first read this book, The Eyes of the Skin, which is something that I think most architectural schools have people read right in the beginning. He's very focused on the experience, the importance of our sensory intelligence in shaping our consciousness and in being creative and sourcing creativity. And something that is very beautiful I've learned from him is how, you know, if you read a lot and your mind is open to things, you have many friends in life. Many of them are from, you know, ancient Greece or ancient Rome, and their art influences you and their writing influences you. So, I mean, David will always be alive for me, and he's always going to be alive for the world. Mm-hmm. So that's not something that's just unique to my personal relationship with him, I don't think. And I didn't notice I talk about him in the present tense. Because I probably talk about him semi in the past tense too, since, you know, we're divorced for probably 20 years.
Well, that's what I'm asking myself. Like, I wonder if he's more present now in a way.
Yeah.
You know, I think a big part of what this is, like, as you say, certain things are coming into focus. Mm-hmm. You're thinking about things differently. They become more real for you. Because there was sort of that question. You were in that sort of little middle space with what is he to you? What are you to him? What were you to each other?
When we last spoke. Yeah. Well, I think that's part of what I thought would be a good idea, because that's changing. It's still changing. That's the thing. Yeah. It will continue to change. Yeah. But something has shifted. You know, like there's a torque that just happened in my universe, David Lynch universe.
Yes.
As there is a David Lynch universe that will live beyond him and that everybody is feeling. Obviously, I do too, and as a family member.
Yes.
And so do the children. So I can't really plant any flags yet, you know. It's a kind of a fluid thing, but it's interesting that it is changing.
Yes.
Because I don't really understand it, honestly.
Yeah. When we spoke on the phone last month, it seemed like two things were happening at the same time. One was that you were really being flooded with a lot of these feelings and these memories and these thoughts.
Yeah.
And the other is that your own personal creative impulses were really firing up again.
Yeah.
Like when I talked to you, I almost couldn't keep track of how quickly your mind was moving in thinking about what you want to do and ideas that were coming to you and projects that had been suddenly launched. Is that still?
Yeah, that's happening still. I think there is something, no matter how much we love our parents, when they pass, you haven't had this experience yet, but both my parents are gone, there's a strange liberation.
Mm.
In it, you know, and my parents were very loving, you know, they were great, and all of my family misses them, but you are now the senior generation.
Yeah, right.
It's that kind of liberation, and your eyes are open to the finite quality of, you know, one's life, and not in a morbid or depressing way, just in a, you're going through another growth spurt, basically. When your parents die, you have to grow up.
Yes. But David isn't
a parent, but no, he is a very essential part of my personal life and my creative life.
Yes.
And there were just certain things that happened. Like, first of all, it's very hard to get to the point where you're editing anything. Back in the, you know, period, I think I talked about this a little bit,
editing. Particularly as a woman, I think it was.
Used to be there were a lot of women in editing originally, and then men dominated it. Now, you know, there's always, it seems to be, a lot of women editors, not necessarily getting, but editors generally don't get much limelight, like many crew members. But I was talking to somebody about the shift from film to Avid or to digital editing, and how I'd already edited several films on film, and begun to sort of develop this visual style of layering and painting with film, basically. But once I, you know, started editing on an Avid, I could put up 6 tracks of video and just start playing with it.
How do you do it with film? Are you actually layering 2 pieces of film over
each
other?
Back when it's film?
Yeah.
Oh, it's an incredible, laborious process where you take the work picture and you mock up, let's just say a simple dissolve, right? So you have a 6-foot dissolve.
Yeah.
So there's 3 feet.
Yeah.
Then it's, you know, the midpoint of the dissolve, it's 3 feet in, right? So you can only cut the work picture up to 3 feet, and you pick up the next shot at 3 feet. You don't know really. You look at it, you run it, I would literally put them both inside the cam and run it to see, you know, if the camera ran out or anything like that. Big mistakes, but also just to get an idea of, like, how's this going to work? How's the light working with the light of the shots? So it's very clunky, like a dentist with pliers to pull teeth. But then, you know, you would mock that up, you'd have that laid out where you cut that at that midpoint with the work picture, and then you draw that grease pencil line you used to always see sometimes on changeovers, back to where the beginning of the dissolve was and down into the next shot of where the end of the dissolve was. You would send it to the lab. The lab would pull the original negative.
Okay.
And they would take, they wouldn't cut anything, but they would take those 2 takes. They'd line them up in an AB in an optical printer and shut the lens and open it on the other one and that print that and make a dupe negative and then print that. They would send it to you and it's like, oh no, I don't like that, you know.
And how
that
long
takes
would that
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Minimum 2 weeks, yeah. So then you're starting on Avid and you're waiting to render and it's like,
for 10 minutes, for an hour, you're annoyed.
But my point is that I had the opportunity, because of that technological change, mid-career for me, really, to launch into like a really much more poetic use of film, painting or sculpting with film. And that I had the opportunity to edit David's films. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, really loved editing on film as well. But then it really felt a little bit like flying. I used it a lot. Straight Story was the first one that I was cutting on Avid, but we did also cut commercials on Avid, so I'd already started exercising that muscle, that new muscle. And
what do you think? We've kind of flirted with this idea, but I mean, first of all of those things, not only are they easy to do, I can do it on my phone now.
Yeah, I know.
And we're actually at another place where AI has been trained on your work and my work, and all the existing
work.
And it'll do things automatically. It'll just make choices based on the sort of the visual language of what, you know, whatever you kind of prompt it to do. I mean, what is your sense of that? Like, what that's going to mean for the whole craft?
Well, it's the same thing for writing. You know, screenplays are doing the same thing. The difference is really simple. I was working, putting these things together because there are certain combinations. It can go just a straight cut from some, you know, like a change in key in music.
Mm-hmm.
Something physiological and emotional happens to people hearing it, people watching it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very powerful, and it's a purely emotional brain, you know, beautiful marriage. When I'm cutting scenes, and particularly in playing with those transitions, I'm absolutely investing emotionally in what I want to feel, what I need to feel at that point, what we're coming from, what we're going to, how I'm going to get an audience to like it not to be abrupt in any way, for it to be seamless for them, for it to be like the dream that they're caught in. And I don't think a computer, AI, can do that.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess if they get sentient, maybe, but we change, our emotions change every second.
I mean, I guess what a computer can do is basically do what it thinks a person would do. This is what would happen given these this set of conditions.
Yeah,
you know?
But unless you're sitting there and you're composing the music, composing the music of the film, you aren't going to experience without your sensory intelligence, your bottom-up and top-down intelligence, you're not going to have that emotional response.
In a way, it's like we can talk all day long about what the rules are, but the rules don't actually... The rules are whatever I feel is right in this moment, given this set of conditions.
Yeah. And the rules are broken with every movie. Every person who's a different person making a movie but having the same emotional and hopefully universal experience in life that they want to put in that film, that they want people all around the world to feel that from their film. That is where fresh things come from in music. You know, and the studios will just replicate that, you know, that's a clunky version of what AI can do.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, and it's not till someone breaks that mold that it, you know, like there's an oversaturation now of all the Marvel, you know, universe, and everybody's waiting for something new.
Yeah.
And it has to come from someone who's got a new idea of how to express themselves.
Yes. Sure, and then everybody chases that.
And then
for a
they
while.
Chase that, exactly.
When you and David split up, was it equally difficult to stop working with him and stop being with him? Was it one that you mourned more than the other? Did they go hand in hand? What was harder to give up in a way?
I mean, the hardest thing was the family.
Yeah.
So I wasn't really thinking about that. I just was thinking about my son and like putting one foot in front of the other and being there for him and really focused on that. And I had already started working at USC. So that was good because I was losing my work of 20 years.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. So honestly, I didn't think about it. I was really focused on Riley, and I had this job that was perfect because it, you know, left me so much more time to be with him and to be taking care of him myself. Because when we were working together, we were working a lot at home. My editing suite was there, and our mixing stage was there. It was a really great compound. We were always there. So Dave and I were working a lot, but we were always home.
Right.
And Riley, I think, had a really good childhood. But now we moved out and, you know, I had support. I had, you know, babysitters and housekeepers and things like that because I was producing and editing his films. And it was really great. I really liked getting back to taking care of Riley myself. And he was 14 when we got divorced, so he wasn't, you know, didn't need, but it was tough.
Yeah.
It was tough. It's a tough age, so.
Were you surprised when your marriage ended, when it came apart?
Yeah, I don't think we're going to talk about that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you say you weren't thinking about work.
Yeah, I'm not sure we want to talk about... I will talk about that in that there is part of, I think, things I'm going through since David passed away, which I wasn't expecting.
Yeah.
Because I've really normalized my life, and I will always love David. I'm not in in love with David anymore. Yeah. But we just had such a great ride, and you know, such a productive, beautiful life, and a beautiful son, and many things that we were grateful to each other for.
Yeah.
But I was surprised that. I guess because I was, as I just said, putting one foot in front of the other and focused on Riley, there were things that I didn't really address.
Yeah.
And really, it was really important to me not to be angry and not to be bitter, because that just folds back on yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It has zero impact, positive for anybody, for me, for David, for Riley especially.
Yeah.
So I think that there were things that emerged and are emerging and I'm working on that I sort of put in a box and didn't think about back then. So I also never really thought about the fact that I was losing all this work. And I had already been teaching for a couple of years as an adjunct. And the year we got divorced, they hired me full-time with tenure. So it just, God closed a door and opened a window.
Your work was... the majority of the work that you've done, the biggest projects that you've done before you started teaching, were very specific and very unique. You had really developed this language. It was very much your thing. But, I mean, I'm not entirely clear even what you teach, but it seems like you're teaching more than just the career of Mary Sweeney.
Uh-huh.
Did you have to sort of pick up and think about what your ideas were and how you would want to teach?
At the time, I'd already, as I said, I'd been teaching in the screenwriting division. I was just, you know, dropped into as an adjunct teaching feature screenwriting. And because I was editing for so many years before I actually wrote the screenplay to Straight Story, I had internalized a very strong editorial sense of the ebb and flow of a feature film. So it was very natural for me to get scripts, read them, and give notes. It was like falling off a log, and my notes are really good.
Yeah.
And I also, you know, it's that emotional investment I make when I'm cutting a scene that I want to feel these things. Part of that is dependent on seeing in performance and in lighting and in in the material that's mm-hmm. not written. It's, you know, the language of cinema, in finding in that the voice, the emotional yeah. core of a scene and then a sequence and then the whole film. I had that same ability in reading scripts where I could, it resonated for me, things that seemed authentic to the writer, even though I didn't know these students right. at all before getting their scripts. So mm. I was a really natural, good feature screenplay teacher. But that's what started this whole class I started. And so now, that was 2006 when I was hired full time. Yeah. And then in 2011 was when I started this class called Dreams, the Brain, and Storytelling, that came out of the fact that I was reading all these really fascinating articles, like in everywhere, the newspaper and magazines and books. There seemed to be an explosion of research about the brain and creativity and behavior, and maybe tied to some development in the fMRI mm-hmm. research, not sure, but all of a sudden it was just in the media and in the ether. And these things were really connecting with my own creative process. Yeah. And I realized that I wasn't really understanding how to articulate my creative process to my students. And so I decided to create this class, and I would explore it with them, and mm-hmm. it would help me. And that's exactly what's happened. And it's helped me identify, like, the artistic skills that I have that are storytelling skills, yes. but they're with cinema,
yeah.
the tools of cinema as an editor, and also writing, screenwriting. But that, again, is informed by having internalized that, you know, that 2 hour, would that they were all 2 hours, narrative structure of a feature film.
Do you, I mean, I've thought about, I talked to Laurie Moore about this a bit, I've talked to people who teach a little bit about this, just the nature of when you are somebody who makes things yourself mm-hmm. and then you're also tasked with
teaching
and fostering other people's creative mm-hmm. process. Are they feeding each other? Does teaching take you away from your own work? Does mm-hmm. it inspire you? Does it frustrate you?
Yeah.
Is it all of the above?
Some of the above, definitely. Because what happens is I instinctively pour a lot of my creative energy,
yeah.
as I just described.
Yeah.
Editing film, it goes into that, and reading a script, it goes into that. Yeah. And so I'm using up a well of creative energy. It makes me a better teacher,
yes.
but it doesn't leave me, you know, full of energy at the end of the day to go home and
make something.
Yeah. But on the other hand, as I read such a variety, with such a range, you know, very beginners to incredibly natural writers to people who are really working hard and very successfully on it, mm-hmm. that I just learned mm-hmm. so much about, you know, good screenwriting. And just through my editorial skills, but also because it was other people's work, and mm-hmm. I was beginning to see things, for example, how it's really characteristic of writers of any level of experience to struggle with a central character that is really closely aligned with not necessarily an experience one has gone through, but it's coming from you. It's your psychology that's mm-hmm. going into this story. And I found so often, and the more inexperienced they were, the more often it happened, that the central character was almost only identified by their relationship with this cast of secondary, tertiary, fabulous, three-dimensional developed characters. And it's just, they couldn't commit to exposing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so the central character, and this has happened to me in a number, and it's notes I've gotten from other people. Hmm. It's like, I can't quite get a grasp on that central character. So that's an example of how
you've learned from
reading teaching.
All of these. So, yeah. Well, I think that's what I'm trying to kind of make my own peace with mm-hmm. as I think about teaching, and mm-hmm. I've just dipped my toe in the water a little bit.
Oh,
it is understanding, yeah, but at the high school level, I've been mm-hmm. teaching a little bit in Long Island mm-hmm. for the last few years, and I think the thing that I'm trying to realize is that the great teachers are not necessarily the ones that know everything. They're the ones that help you find it and find it with you.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And I think higher education, all education, is beginning to understand that.
Yeah.
And so my course, which is really hard to define,
yeah.
is wildly popular.
Yeah,
because,
sure.
well, one reason is we watch a lot of movies in a beautiful theater.
Yeah.
And many people have seen these movies, yeah. but not on a big screen.
Yeah.
They watch it on their computers. And so part of the message, the experience, which I articulate to them, yeah. at the beginning of the semester is that I've curated
yeah.
this series of films, and yeah. I refresh it every year, like an LP. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a rhythm, an ebb and flow mm-hmm. to what we're watching. And every week, because we're in this room together in the dark with 5.1 sound, actually, I guess it's Atmos, mm-hmm. and a big screen, we are all simultaneously having an emotional experience that we're sharing with one another, and we're sharing it from week to week. And at the end of the semester, we have a 15-week mm-hmm. emotional shared experience.
With each
other. Yeah,
that really resonates with me. My dad and I had this kind of breakthrough in COVID where we had spent months not together mm-hmm. watching music online. Uh-huh. And then I went to Madison in August of that year and we watched music online together.
Uh-huh. Sitting next to each other
watching a live stream. Mm-hmm. And the experience was so different of just the two of us.
Yeah.
Synchronizing and breathing together and watching yeah. this.
And reacting.
And reacting.
That's the thing. You're reacting. It's a shared, unconscious, 60 people unconscious yeah. experience. Yes.
But it also raises this question of cinema in general. And, well, we know that most content, which mm-hmm. is what we are reduced to being makers of today, yeah. is consumed on the phone or on the, you know, yeah. maybe on a nice TV in somebody's house, maybe.
With
but
good
like,
sound, but yeah. it's just one person, two person,
maybe two.
People. Yeah.
So how do you think that's changing the process and the experience of making?
I mean, cinema? The people who love cinema and yeah. who make cinema, they're yeah. still making it to
For
be
the theater.
Seen and heard in a theater. The best filmmakers and the new young filmmakers, yeah. they all, everybody wants it. And they yeah. make it. They spend the time in the yeah. mix and they, you know, the way they shoot it, you know, and you know, The Brutalist, you know, shot in VistaVision. Mm. You know, it's just...
What did you think of The Brutalist?
No comment.
Okay. But they shot it on VistaVision.
They shot it on VistaVision yeah. and, you know, it was, you know, an homage. And yeah. that filmmaker was absolutely intent on it being experienced in yeah. a movie theater.
Is there a contemporary film, a recent film that you've seen that you would comment on? That is there something that you've seen recently that you thought this was... Or that you would want to show in a
yeah.
class? Or
well, I mean... So some of the more recent things that I show, some of them aren't so recent now, in the class,
yeah.
is I show, I don't know how old this is now, Steve McQueen made a TV series called Small Axe, Steve yeah. McQueen, 12 Years a Slave. And there's one episode in there called Lovers Rock that I have been, so that's a 70-minute, it's yeah. you know, a series. There's something about that film that is just completely immersive and mm. mesmerizing.
I'm trying to ask, put myself in a position of thinking... If somebody asked me a question, and I'm making no assumptions about why you said no comment. If somebody asked me a question that I don't know if maybe you know people that are involved in it, or you just don't want to be on the record as having an opinion about something, if...
You know, I have opinions about, because, you know, it's very rare to make a movie that everybody loves.
Sure.
And everybody has movies they love.
Yeah.
And there are many, many people who just don't get our movies
yes.
and never will and don't care.
Yeah.
So I am being that way out of respect to the time... and energy
yeah.
and life and passion that people put into their movies.
Sure.
And also I'm an editor, so yeah. I just inevitably,
see
you know,
things.
It's not so much that I see things, it's, you know, I just feel things and I'm not feeling things is more often the problem. And that is, you know, maybe an overly sensitive perspective.
Sure.
And I just feel like there are, you know, there's always something that I will admire about a film because I know what goes into making a film.
Sure.
And I know how it's a total myth that filmmakers are thick-skinned and don't mm-hmm. care what the public think. It's like you can get 100 beautiful reviews and you get one bad review and it just really bugs you. And you feel really hurt.
Yeah.
It's very personal, yeah. as you know, Faye Dunaway says. It couldn't be more personal.
It's funny. Sometimes I have been, as the podcast has gone on, I've been approached to have opinions or be have a more critical ear. Mm-hmm. And some musicians have contacted me and said, you have a platform, you have a responsibility. Uh-huh. And I've always said, I absolutely do not have that responsibility. All I want to do is yeah. talk to people about their experience yeah. of the work. I'm not here to actually pass any judgment on
yeah.
the work.
Yeah.
And I very much relate to what you say, mm-hmm. which is like out of respect for the
human. Yeah, for the artist.
Yes.
Yeah, for the artist.
Yeah.
artists and scientists are really, really important right now. And that's something else that has come out of the class. Is I've collaborated with a neuroscientist. He lectures one class every year. And then we made the podcast, too, during COVID, where we alternated interviewing neuroscientists and artists. It wasn't anything I thought about consciously. But I also think that that's something that's happening in the world. There's a need to respond to how crazy the world has gotten. And artists are, of course, a mirror. Mm. And they have that kind of ability to step back with a kind of Google Earth view of things and see like the pieces of the puzzle and have it inspire them to make a sculpture or make a painting, or, you know, it's just been an important role in their life through history. And scientists are also in their own way just seeking like the meaning of life. That's what they're both doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, scientists are doing it in that very creative way of trying to figure out how things are working.
Yeah.
It's kind of beautiful. And I think there's this mind meld going on, you know, around the world between those two classes, if we'll call them that, of people who are really creative as scientists and as artists.
It's interesting that you became sensitive to what artists are when you started from a sort of a craft angle.
Absolutely, and ended up completely fulling expressing poetry.
How much longer do you think you'll want to teach?
I'm now the chair. I have a 3-year commitment, 1 year down, 2 to go. And I would, you know, like to honor that commitment. And I feel like this transitional period that we're all of the higher education is in right now, and that, again, to speak to the importance of scientists and artists and their ability to express themselves, I mean, the old order is collapsing. Mm-hmm. It's not doing it in a very pretty way either. And there's a lot of damage that's happening in the process. But, you know, with crisis comes opportunity also.
I said to you when we were on the phone last month, I'm scared because my business is changing. Every area of my business is changing. I'm not going to be able to do it in the same way moving forward. I can just tell AI is some of it. The business itself has changed. Mm-hmm. And I said, I feel like maybe I have to go get a job. And, you know, and it was funny because I had literally been asking myself, what? I mean, could I be a CPA? Like, could I get a job? And you said to me on the phone, this is not the time to become an accountant. And it's not, I hadn't even mentioned that. But as I was just running the list.
You didn't say you run to be thinking about becoming, but I said
but
that.
You said that.
That's so funny.
And because I was just almost like a little kid, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? Astronaut, fireman, whatever.
Yeah,
I was just
start thinking of
running. What are careers? What do people do?
Yeah, find myself a city to live in.
And you said to me, this is not the time to become an accountant. This is the time to find opportunity in this. There's opportunity for you, and there's opportunity to be creative, to double down on creativity, which is both inspirational and also like a little abstract in the way, because it falls on us to figure out where that opportunity is.
Well, I mean, you have a huge foundation to work from.
Right.
You've had a whole variety of things that you do, and they all have to do with music, and music is not going to go away.
Right.
And I don't think cinema is going to go away either. Mm-hmm. And we just need to like kind of step back. Like I was saying, it's like, okay, there's nothing we should really think of. Like a lot of people, this happens in this kind of change always, where people start to think of things that are related to the old order that'll be an interim thing.
Yeah.
And they put their eggs in that
in
basket.
That thing, yeah.
But the speed with which our world is changing, that's a waste of time.
Yeah.
And so, for example, when I think about, this is not something I embrace, but what I think about screenwriting. Okay, who is going to be paid for screenwriting? I can see that the human element is going to be necessary for some time, even if AI is going to make everything better. They're going to write better and better scripts, but they're not going to write emotionally new or fresh scripts. Maybe that will change. Mm-hmm. I kind of hope I'm not around for that. But you know, they still need humans to inject emotions into it. So what that means is, you know, people who have a lot of experience will become script doctors. And they'll be able to make a lot, they can demand a lot of money. And so that's a smaller group of writers.
Exactly.
It's naturally in this kind of revolution, the bourgeois revolution, the industrial revolution, many jobs disappear and they get narrowed down and new jobs are created. But you are experiencing something that is gonna transcend,
yeah,
whatever that is. And even if you aren't pressing enough to see the yeah future, you know, it's going to be presenting itself and changing a lot. So you kind of have to, I mean, the image I like is like, we kind of got to like just jump up about a foot off the mm-hmm ground. Or just, I'm not suggesting levitation yeah or anything right transcendental. Just kind of hang there because everything under us is shifting.
You know, you say jobs will be lost. Do you sense that today there are many more people trying to make film-related content than there were when you got into the business?
I think there are many, many more people replacing making film with short
yeah
things.
Yeah, yeah.
Webisodes, now TikTok.
Sure.
And like that's finite, I guess. Yeah. It's like, and there will be a saturation of like, that's not satisfactory and a pendulum will swing back. I think there are really great films being made, like for, like much more interesting films.
Yeah.
Than have been being made.
But I think you could argue the same in music too. There's just yeah a lot. There's yeah so much that we can't even, there's no way we can even consume it. But when you talk about AI as a reality, it's going to write, we're going to need script mm-hmm doctors. I mean, I feel the same way about
music.
Music, mm-hmm, certainly music in any industrial or, you know, like advertising, any of that stuff.
Absolutely.
Even providing music as a service, which is something that, one thing that I do. Mm-hmm. I'm already in conversation with somebody else's vision.
Mm, yeah.
Depending on how they want to work, they're more or less specific and controlling or open-minded or whatever. But mm-hmm assuming that you're dealing with somebody who has pretty strong ideas about mm-hmm what they want, I think they would be probably well served to work for a while with an AI tool to get
yeah
close to what they want.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems like it makes perfect sense.
Yes. Yeah, it does. I think that producers will probably be, studios will generate first drafts of concepts that get up in the executive suite.
Incredible.
And then turn it over to someone to rewrite.
Yeah. But now do we think, is this the most cynical expression of where we've come already, or is this a good thing?
I don't think it's a good thing. No. Yeah. I yeah definitely don't think it's yeah a good thing. Yeah. And I think that the product will suffer.
Yeah.
Music won't have human passion.
Yeah. And maybe it won't surprise you. I mean, the question is, can these things surprise you? Like, because they have their own point of view.
Yeah. I mean, they don't have a point of view. They have, you know, variations on a theme yeah that they yeah can just, like, in a second.
Yeah.
So David Sally, the painter, did this experiment with his own AI robot or something, where he fed a bunch of his paintings and drawings, I guess, into it. It was an article in the New York Times. I might be misquoting it, but mm-hmm that's, I think, what happened. And he talked about how he would give him a line of poetry and say, generate, you know, a David Sally visual
yeah, sure
version of this. And there was a lot of bad things. But he also said that there were some sort of, you know, things that happened because they were informed by his body of work, that they were maybe, if he made another 15 paintings, he would have arrived at himself because he liked it. Here's my problem with that, and I've talked a lot about the idea of something that I think is problematic, but it's history. There's no way we can change it or go back. Going from analog film editing to digital editing, which is the focus and the concentration you have to have, because you just can have one strip of film up at a time, mm-hmm, and you don't have the nonlinear access. And the kind of investment when you watch dailies the first time, and the kind of notes you take of anything that has a physiological impact on
yes
you. And so if people are watching dailies in high speed, that's anything faster than 24 frames a second, I guess, they're gonna not have that same physiological reaction, and they're gonna miss things, mm-hmm, and they're gonna miss gold, and they're not gonna work as hard because it's so easy to say, well, let's try this, you know, this way, and you could just go in and change a scene really fast, and AI is gonna make that even faster.
Do you think, I'm trying to remember if I have some sort of vague sense memory of talking about watching dailies with David, and would he have memories from the set
the shoot,
that
yeah
he would say to you, it's this take, I think it's this take?
Yeah, when he's on the set,
yeah,
with every take,
yeah,
I mean with every setup,
yeah,
he indicates one or two or sometimes three preferences. And so if he goes through it, it's like, okay, that's a keeper, but let's try it again kind of thing. The script person will have circled things
that's
that
on set before you even watch.
That's
dailies
on set before I'm watching the dailies. And also, he stopped watching dailies. You know, we didn't watch dailies together anymore. Mm. It was just too time consuming. And, you know, we used for the first couple of weeks, we'll watch dailies because all the keys come and they look at what the production design looks like, the, you know, cinematography, and that's really important. But then he just stops watching them. It's like they just put all their time into production. And my first job of the day was to just go through the unsunk picture and make sure there were no negative scratches and stuff like that. But I did that in real time too. And I, even though I didn't have dialogue and I wasn't thinking about the scene yet, I would always call him because I, you know, I would just be seeing incredible things just with the picture, you know, that I'd get.
And you would tell him what?
I was very excited about it. And this is really important to him. And I needed to call him to tell them and the production that there were no negative problems. So as soon as I would go through it, I made that call. But he always wanted to talk to me because he wanted to hear, you know, how they looked, and because he wasn't going to look at them. And also because I was always excited, and that was really good for him. You know, he could read me like a book, you know.
In what sense?
You know, if I was trying to hedge about anything, I get very far. And it was discouraging if I wasn't, you know,
totally
really excited.
Totally into it.
Yeah, not totally into it, but I just was very engaged. I mean, it's the final rewrite. You're very engaged in the storytelling as the editor. And I was always, you know, it was a very rich life and work. And yeah, I didn't have to pretend to be enthusiastic.
Have you worked as an editor since working with David?
I edited my own film.
Yes.
And I do make short films myself, but I haven't been hired by anybody else, no.
Was there ever a part of you that wanted to?
There wasn't really any part of me that wanted to. I didn't even think about it. I didn't look for it. I never had an agent because I only worked with David. So I didn't go looking, and I didn't really come to mind. I was probably tied to David's work. I don't know. You know, I had a BAFTA. I was pretty satisfied. I think also it took me some years to even come around to thinking of like, oh, maybe I should edit something. But when I think about the experience I had and how transcendent that was as a 20-year collaboration, you know.
So, but this is a very rich area, to be honest with you, because you don't teach film editing in a film program.
No, I'm happy I don't teach film editing,
But the experience that prepared you to teach was as an editor. Absolutely take what you say, that all of that editing prepared you to be able to see a script.
And to write a script.
Yeah. But the experience itself, the thing came out of editing.
Yeah.
And I think it's really kind of notable that once it was over, you said, well, maybe the thing wasn't that you were an editor, it was that you were a collaborator.
This is what I was saying about what happened when I was able to start painting, you know, with Avid, was that I recognized my artistic life.
Do you see yourself as an editor? If somebody were to say, tell me about
yourself.
Not now,
but I mean, it's very important, and it is my most artistic work, you know. Including, you know, my film or, you know, the short films I make. It's all in those films.
Yeah.
And it's my particular kind of poetry or artistic investment and emotional creativity. It's interesting. I mean, because it does transcend. I mean, I went to this Hockney show yesterday. Yeah. It was so mind-blowing. Yes. He's so productive.
I saw it in London.
Oh, my God.
Unbelievable.
And it's so beautiful
that
you find that. So, you know, to go back to a question I didn't really want to talk about, I would say all parts of our life together are so resonant and such rich memories and so beautiful and such an incredible opportunity and like learning and artistic expression, all of that. But I do at times miss that art that I got so good at.
Yes.
But I can't imagine
doing it with anybody else.
No. And I am, one of the things I think that I'm coming around to is I have been painting, and I'm painting more, but I'm also thinking I should be making more and more short films and not narrative necessarily films, but using those skills, you know, to make art.
I'm prepared for you to say you don't want to talk about this. I'm going to frame.
I've trained you now. It's good for one to learn that just because people ask questions doesn't mean you're entitled to an answer.
Sure.
And you have to, people have to think about that.
When
people
they ask
who
the
are
question.
Being asked questions, you know, people have to think about that and realize you don't have to answer these questions if you don't want to talk about it. Or you're not ready to talk about it, or it's just something that's too private. And I really have a strong sense of privacy, and I think that's a good thing.
You said earlier that editors are often overlooked in general. I actually think in many ways, a lot of people did pay attention to your relationship with David and noticed that you, that who's this person that's involved mm-hmm. in all these mm-hmm. things? And that's why I think that group of women editors that found our interview were so excited that there you were talking about it, because they clearly had been aware of you, but they couldn't find any documents of you talking.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, it does seem that your participation in his career was overlooked pretty significantly in the major obits and uh-huh. stories that people told about David's career.
Yeah. You know, editors are invisible. And everybody in, you know, the immediate vicinity generally of a famous person is pretty invisible. That you know, that's just that fact of life. And you look at any famous person and you know, may or may not know that their husband or wife is their agent or their manager or their, you know, editor or their producer, any of these things. You know, there's a lot of, you know, media heat on that person. So that just comes with the territory. I mean, I guess what you're saying, I have noted that, and I don't quite understand it. So I don't know what to say about it.
Because you were also producing. I mean, if editors are invisible, what about producers?
Producers, yeah, they're eclipsed by, you know, I mean, you think of any famous filmmaker, you probably can't name their producers.
That's right.
Yeah. And they don't care, generally, because they have a lot of control. they don't always want.
the credit or the limelight.
The media limelight. Yeah. That has become a dangerous thing now.
Right. Part of me thinks, okay, there may be a part of it in which David was complicit, and I don't know, but then there's another part of it, which is that the world is complicit in the sense that they need their geniuses to be completely individual, self-sufficient geniuses.
Yeah, that's, and also the downside of that is it's all them if the movie is not good. You know, so it's a very lonely place being a director. I'm not saying I'm playing my violin here it, but that is a real fact of that life. You're very isolated, especially the more famous you are. I mean, I think possibly a contribution is that I don't seek the limelight. And, you know, I'm not ever trying to make a point of what role I had in this life or whatever. I just, my reaction always in my life to any kind of, you know, like shock, like a divorce, is to, you know, really draw into a cave and just, you know, have the privacy to recover.
Yeah.
And to protect my son, same thing. So who knows, Leo? It's the world, and the film business is a very fickle place. And media can make whatever they want. I'm just grateful that I haven't been made an ogre of for some reason. You know, that's how we have to live these days. But, you know, but all of that stuff is happening well before the kind of media world that we live in now, where there's no privacy and there's, you know, viral activity and canceling and bullying and all those things. And but everything lasts very briefly, anyhow, it seems.
Yes.
Yeah. But I will say also that, you know, there were many very valuable partners of a filmmaker who are invisible. It's not just editors, sound designers are another one.
Yeah.
And composers, even, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't help thinking about my own life when you say, well, who could I possibly collaborate with in the same way that would make, that would even come close to making me feel, obviously nobody.
Yeah.
I mean, I think about that with my father, right?
Yeah.
Like most of my professional life is tied in one way or another to, and particularly as a drummer.
Yeah.
Like, for a long time, my father and I have been preparing.
Mm-hmm.
We're preparing together.
Yeah.
You know?
I think that's really a beautiful gift you're giving him, by the way.
Well, he's giving me, too, that he's willing to talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. I know, but you are, I mean, I've seen this with many friends of mine as they age in different contexts where people, they don't work together at all.
Yeah.
Where there's a certain point where that changeover happens where the parent is being taken care of. Yeah. And you've done it in such a gracious way. I've watched you guys in your performances where it's like you've got a new shtick on stage, which is you sort of just, you know, poking him, teasing him, and he loves it.
Yeah.
And he sort of, like, gets really funny, and it's a different dynamic, and it's so, like, that you're sharing that with the public is really beautiful. Yeah.
Well, and I think I relate also to the subtlety of the performative aspect. I mean, maybe you didn't fully feel this because mm-hmm. it's not like you and David ever went out on a stage and had to like right. demonstrate.
Edit things together.
Edit yeah. things together in front of people or whatever. But there is a kind of performative nature mm-hmm. that is both extremely revealing and is also controlled.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's yeah, of course.
It's what's being, what we choose to share and mm-hmm. what we don't choose to share. But it's a fine line to walk. You know, I mean,
yes,
maybe one
is, yeah.
one day I'll
yeah.
find myself in an yeah. interview and I'll say to somebody, yeah. I'm not going to talk about
yeah.
that, you know?
No, but it's different because he can't divorce you.
Right, right. That's right.
That's why it's, you know, divorces are, you know, hard yeah. for people to talk about. Not that ours was pretty civilized.
Yeah.
That's a different situation than
yeah, losing you're absolutely
someone.
Right.
Yeah. And that's why this is interesting, because what's happening now is that I processed a lot of things, you know, over the last 20 years, but I am now needing to process it, as I said at the beginning, through a different lens, which is a better lens, mm-hmm. for sure. I'm not shocked anymore.
Yeah.
And I have a very full life.
Yeah.
And it seems to be kind of blossoming in response to it. Maybe it's a gift, you know, David yeah. left me, who knows.
You really have had an extraordinary life. To think where you came from and maybe what the expectations might have been for somebody from a big family, you know, in Madison, and like to go as far as you went mm-hmm. and to have made all this contribution. And I say that to say you earned everything that you did, and everything that you did belongs to you, but it is also in conversation with mm-hmm. so much of it with somebody else's work.
Yeah.
And then that experience is also personal. So mm-hmm. that's where I think it is a complex and more complex than many other people who have had a career somewhat like yours, mm-hmm. because I don't know how you, quote unquote, own your work mm-hmm. independent of the relationship.
Yeah. I mean, I think you could say that about any editor, director, mm. team.
Okay.
So I'm good friends with Joe Walker, who did a lot of Steve McQueen's work,
uh-huh.
and also is still working with Denis Villeneuve,
uh-huh.
and won the Oscar for The Second Dune
wow.
Last year, or a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they both have their own partners outside of the cutting room. But every director-editor relationship, and it's different on big films where there's like six editors.
Yeah.
And many editors, you know, they work with different directors, and they have, but, you know, then there are people like Joe and me and Thelma and other people where it's just like, you're what the director trusts, and it works,
yeah.
and they stick with you. So that is the things you were just saying.
Yeah.
Without those people being in a marriage
yeah.
with the directors, that's true of them,
yes.
too. And it is something that is just, it's really important, and the director and the editor know it. It's a really important relationship, and it needs to be important because it can ruin a film if it isn't,
mm-hmm.
and people will get fired for sure. But it's
and
not
people, that's
just,
what I was going to ask. People can get fired. Those marriages can come apart. Those
oh, definitely.
Creative marriages get,
I mean, marriages,
sure.
Sometimes they come apart. I mean, yeah. if a filmmaker just runs into a rough patch,
mm-hmm.
they will change the personnel. They'll mm-hmm. change their team, and it's
try
not
everything.
Just the editor.
Yeah.
You know, it's the cinematographer,
yeah.
it's the actors.
Sure.
You know, so people like David and Steven Spielberg and Denis Villeneuve, they stick with actors that mm-hmm. they like, and
sure.
they're in a rhythm, and you know, with their whole team, and it really is a huge boon to have moved from movie to movie with people and know that, you know, you don't have to go through the anxiety of building a new relationship
yes.
of people. All of them are very important to the director.
Yeah.
So it's not just editors.
That's a very fair point, that they're all marriages on the, in some
oh, on I think
some
nothing
level.
More than an editor and director.
Yeah.
That's definitely a marriage. And
yeah.
I assisted other editors, and you know, that's
yeah.
you know, that those were intense relationships too. You know, you just you know, you really rely on people. You're working so crazy. Your hours are so crazy, especially in film. Oh my God.
And so did David, he must have worked with other editors then in the lab.
Oh yeah, he worked with, well, Dwayne Dunham, who mm-hmm. I assisted on
yeah.
Blue Velvet and
yeah.
Wild at Heart. And I forget.
But after you, I mean.
Oh, after me. Oh, well, he was the editor of
uh-huh.
Inland Empire.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So after
yeah.
you, irreplaceable, it was you or no one.
Yeah, it's complicated. That's complicated, something I'm not ready to talk about yet. But
okay. I really respect your boundaries. I mean, I maybe it doesn't seem like I do.
You can try, because I feel fine. Yeah. You know, we're friends. I feel fine, and you totally respect it when I say I'm not ready to talk about that, I mean, or I don't ever want to talk about that.
I mean, I respect it also as somebody who struggles with boundaries and struggles with figuring out where they are, you know? And I just want to acknowledge that I appreciate watching you. I'm learning from you as I watch you do this. I just see how each event is another opportunity to decide. So Mary Sweeney, thank you for taking these opportunities with me today and for commenting as much as you have. I appreciate you as a friend, and
likewise,
we'll do more.
I've really enjoyed this. It's good for me to talk these things out too, and figure it out as I go.
There she was, my friends, Mary Sweeney, figuring it out as she goes. What a soulful and searching talk. In the spirit of giving credit where credit is due, you should know that The Third Story is made by me. I produced, host, and edited at Third Story HQ in Brooklyn, New York, and you can support it on Substack. I'll be back again in your headspace with another deep dive before you know it. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.